are in listen-only mode.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's webinar, Understanding Privacy Laws for Physical and Behavioral Health Information Sharing. This is Veronica Guerra, Policy Analyst with the Office of Oregon Health Policy and Research. Thank you all for joining us. Before we get started, there are a few housekeeping items that I'd like to cover. By default, you have joined using your computer speaker system. If you would prefer to join over the telephone, just select telephone in the audio pane and the dial-in information will be displayed. Please note that all phone lines are muted during today's webinar. You will have the opportunity to submit written questions to the presenters by typing your questions into the questions pane of the control panel. We will answer questions at the end, but please feel free to submit your questions at any point during the webinar. The webinar will be recorded and will be disseminated to everyone participating today. Lastly, if you experience any technical difficulties during this call, please contact us using the chat feature on the right side of your screen. So today we will hear from Leslie Clement, Director of Health Policy and Analytics with the Oregon Health Authority, who will provide an overview of the Behavioral Health Information Sharing Advisory Group, which is attempting to address issues regarding exchange of protected health information. Then Kate Tipping, Public Health Advisor with the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, and Deanna Laidler, Senior Assistant Attorney General with the Oregon Department of Justice, will provide an overview of 42 CFR Part 2, HIPAA and state privacy laws. Laura Roses, Public Health Advisor and Health Information Technology Lead with the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, will review some of the federal efforts around behavioral health and health information technology. And Nicole Corbin, Adult Behavioral Health Services Manager with the Oregon Health Authority, will review mechanisms to work with Part 2 to share information between providers. Finally, we will review next steps and resources and wrap up with Q&A. I'll now turn it over to Leslie Clement.
Thanks, Veronica, and welcome. The Behavioral Health Information Sharing Advisory Group was created because the Oregon Health Authority leadership heard various CCOs state that information sharing was a major stumbling block to the care coordination purposes. There were significant confusion about the type of information that can be shared given Part 2 protection. Several CCOs sought guidance from their attorneys, but were unable to obtain clarity on federal and state law because of limited expertise, particularly around Part 2. The goal of the advisory group is to develop solutions that will support care coordination and the OHA's vision of integrated care and services. This is a critical step in supporting the coordinated care model and realizing the goals of the AAA. Because there is a cross-cutting issue that touches several parts of DHS and OHA, we have brought together a variety of internal partners, including addictions and mental health experts, experts from the medical assistance programs, aging and people with disabilities, information security and privacy, the developmental disability services staff, Office of Health Information Technology, and the Transformation Center. The advisory group conducted a provider survey to assess the needs and challenges providers face when sharing behavioral health information, which led to the identification of four priorities. First priority, outreach to stakeholders. To build buy-in for the group solution, it will be increasingly important to engage in outreach to internal and external partners that will be impacted by our work. We began this effort by conducting a provider survey to understand the barriers to information sharing. I will touch briefly on the results of that survey shortly. Second priority, education. Providers often interpret the requirements of federal and state privacy laws as more restrictive than they actually are. So we decided that education will be critical to demystify common misconceptions. third priority, leverage existing IT solutions. We landed on the third priority because several providers were unaware of existing IT solutions that might be helpful in exchanging PHI. An example is the DSM. And the fourth priority, to develop tools to facilitate information sharing. We decided on the fourth priority because we found that providers approach information exchange in disparate manners, and there often seems to be a lack of uniformity in process, policies, and standards. A few highlights from the provider survey conducted earlier this year. 54% of participants self-identified as behavioral health provider, and that is broken down further here by mental health provider, substance use disorder provider, or mental health and SUDS provider combined. 13% identified as a primary care provider, and 33% marked other. The other category would include some of the non-provider participants that completed the surveys, like CCOs, CEOs, and quality managers. A majority of providers practice in an urban setting and within a CCO network. 91% exchange a patient's personal information with other providers in order to support service and care delivery, including care coordination and planning. But nearly half of the participants are rarely or never able to exchange information, any type of patient information electronically, meaning that many are using non-electronic means to exchange PHI. The three major barriers to electronically sharing behavioral health information among providers included confusion over compliance with state or federal laws, that was 44%, concerns over privacy and security protection for the patient, that's 38%. State or federal laws prohibit the type of sharing that is needed or wanted, that's 37%. Other barriers that were identified included internal technology systems that don't capture behavioral health data appropriately, that's 33%. Concerns over provider liability if the information is later shared inappropriately, that was 31%. And inability to separate out behavioral health information while sharing patient records, 28%. And then finally, lack of proper consent forms from the patient, and that was 25%. The top three solutions or resources that providers identified would be very helpful in addressing barriers to electronically sharing behavioral health information included improved technological solutions for easier sharing, 75%, design of a model or universal consent form, 64%, continued advocacy for federal action on changes to 42 CFR Part 2, and that was 54%. Other solutions or resources that providers felt would be very helpful included personalized assistance or support for your organization, 39%. Information on how others have tackled similar issues, 39%. And an instructional webinar about applicable state, federal laws, and common misperceptions, that was 38%. There are three main takeaways from the provider survey. Provider concerns go well beyond technological capacity. As you heard, many concerns were related to privacy and confidentiality of patient information and the ability to understand and comply with restrictions imposed on information sharing by federal and state privacy laws. Solutions developed by the advisory group must account for existing variations in provider knowledge, health system capability, and the level of health information technology. Any proposed solutions will need to be all-encompassing and include options for those that may not have robust technological systems or capacity. Some of the identified barriers are related to misconceptions of federal and state privacy laws, many of which are related to the protections in Part 2 that safeguard the patient's privacy. Therefore, it is important for providers to become knowledgeable about applicable state and federal laws so they can effectively coordinate care with the existing with existing federal and state privacy laws. Over the next 9 months, the advisory group will conduct two additional webinars. The next webinar is tentatively scheduled for November 10th from 1 to 3. They'll develop a model qualified service organization agreement for CCOs to use with Part 2 providers. We'll work with Jefferson HIE and OHA's Office of Health Information Technology on a collaborative ONC grant. The grant will address health information exchange across physical and behavioral health care settings and incorporate social services and other non-traditional providers. And we can help communicate the results from this work to providers. We also intend to develop a provider toolkit that will include an overview and comparison of federal and state privacy laws, case studies of allowable sharing, results, and products from the ONC grant work, model forms, and FAQs. And finally, we intend to continue to engage our federal partners in discussions about Part 2.
Great. Thank you, Leslie. Now, Kate Tipping will provide an overview of 42 CFR Part 2.
Thank you, Veronica. I will go give a high-level overview of 42 CFR Part 2. As Leslie alluded to through the survey, and as you all may know, Part 2 is a fairly complex regulation, so I'm happy to, you know, answer questions at the end, but I'll just give a high level at this point. So the privacy of health information is governed by both federal and state law, and the two federal laws are HIPAA and 42 CFR Part 2. 42 CFR Part 2 protects the confidentiality of alcohol and drug treatment and prevention information. There's also many state laws that protect sensitive health information, including HIV information, mental health information, or other sensitive health information. Next slide. So protecting the confidentiality of people receiving substance use disorder treatment, we must find a balance between the ability to share the information among physical health and behavioral health providers. Next slide. And so the purpose of 42 CFR Part 2 is really to encourage people to seek treatment without fear that by doing so their privacy will be compromised. If there is an unauthorized sharing of information or information is shared without the patient's consent, there's a number of consequences that can lead to, including criminal legal consequences, civil legal consequences, including loss of child custody or loss of employment or housing. And they can also suffer from discrimination from others, including healthcare providers. So next slide. So who is covered under 42 CFR Part 2? The regulations apply to any federally assisted alcohol and drug abuse program. A program is defined in the regulations as either an individual or entity other than a general medical facility that holds itself out as providing and does provide alcohol or drug abuse diagnosis, treatment, or referral for treatment. So under this part of the definition, that could include freestanding drug and alcohol treatment programs. And for the second part of the definition, it would be an identified unit within a general medical facility which holds itself out as providing and does provide drug and alcohol diagnosis, treatment, or referral for treatment. And this could be a hospital that has a unit dedicated for substance use disorder treatment. And they would fall within the definition of a program. And then the third definition is medical personnel in within a general medical facility whose primary function is the provision of drug and alcohol diagnosis, treatment, or referral for treatment, and that those providers are identified as such specialists. So this could be in a primary care practice, but there's an individual provider within the practice that is primarily dedicated to treating addiction, and they're identified as such by that practice, then they would be a program under 42 CFR Part 2 and need to comply with the requirements in Part 2. The regulations do not define what we mean by holds itself out. SAMHSA has put out some guidance in the form of frequently asked questions that holds itself out could mean if they advertise or post notices in the office that they treat addiction or certifications in addiction medicines, listings in different registries, or even internet statements. It's basically anything that would lead one to reasonably conclude that this individual is providing addiction treatment services. Next slide. So the general rule under 42 CFR Part 2 is that the disclosure of information that would identify a patient either directly or indirectly as having either a current or past drug or alcohol problem is generally prohibited, unless the patient consents in writing or another limited exception applies. So Part 2 does lay out 9 required elements for obtaining patient consent, which needs to be included in the consent form. And then there are a number of exceptions, including medical emergency, qualified service organization, audits and evaluations, research purposes, which some of these will be discussed in more detail later in the presentation. And then the next slide is with regard to the redisclosure of Part 2 information. So once information is disclosed with patient consent, that information may not be redisclosed unless the patient then again consents to disclose that information to another party. Any disclosure authorized by consent must be accompanied by a statement notifying the recipient of the information that the Part 2 information is prohibited from being further redisclosed unless the patient consents to sharing that information. Okay, next slide. So I'm just going to go over a few myths about 42 CFR Part 2. One of the things that we've been hearing is that, you know, people can't share Part 2 protected information ever without obtaining patient consent. So the first myth is all disclosures require authorization or consent. So HIPAA does not require authorization for disclosures or uses that are for treatment, payment, or healthcare operations. 42 CFR Part 2 does require consent unless one of those limited exceptions apply. And then the next myth is that no one outside the health system can access the protected health information. And under HIPAA does permit disclosures for public health activities, victim of abuse or neglect, judicial administrative proceedings, law enforcement, threats to health or safety, court-ordered examinations, correctional facilities, and business associate agreements. And 42 CFR Part 2 does permit disclosures for research, child abuse reporting, crimes on premises against program staff, criminal justice system if treatment is a condition of parole or release, or other systems with patient consent or if there's a qualified service organization agreement in place. And each of those exceptions under 42 CFR Part 2, they also have a number of criteria that needs to be met in order to qualify for that exception. And then the third one is that the federal law prohibits staff from the same agency or organization from talking to each other. And the fact is that both HIPAA and Part 2 permit interagency or intra-agency exchanges of information. And under 42 CFR Part 2, there has to be a showing that they're under the personnel are under the same direct administrative control or there's a qualified service organization agreement in place, but there is some allowance for folks within the same agency or organization to talking with one another and exchanging that information. We do understand what you all are working on and the importance of the CCOs, and as you are aware, the 42 CFR Part 2 regulations haven't been substantively updated since 1987. So as Leslie had mentioned, in the survey that 54% of folks are looking to change or revise some of the federal regulations, and that's something that SAMHSA is taking a look at currently. We had a listening session last June to get some public input on different provisions within the regulations that are problematic for folks, specifically with regard to the consent requirements and the to whom section or with the recipient of the information. So we are taking a careful look at those now, and we will provide more information as it becomes available. And next is a number of resources, both on the SAMHSA website, but also with regard to the Legal Action Center has put out some helpful information with regard to 42 CFR Part 2. And that's the high-level overview of Part 2.
Thank you, Kate. Now we'll pass it on to Deanna Laidler, who will review HIPAA and state laws governing the confidentiality of behavioral health information. Deanna?
Yes, thank you, Veronica. When we look at the various issues, as Kate mentioned, when we're looking at laws governing privacy and confidentiality of health information, we do primarily look to those three general categories of laws, HIPAA, Oregon laws, and 42 CFR Part 2. Now, HIPAA sets a minimum standard regarding confidentiality of protected health information and will preempt a contrary state law that affords less protection to the privacy of protected health information. Conversely, if a state law affords greater protection to the individual, the state law will prevail over HIPAA. While it's generally assumed that providers can comply with both HIPAA and 42 CFR Part 2, if the laws conflict, the provider must comply with whichever law is more restrictive. Now, the primary focus of this presentation today is the exchange of information for care coordination purposes, so much of my analysis is going to focus on that particular issue. So this one just kind of provides an overview, and again, a very high-level overview of HIPAA. It does apply to various covered entities, including healthcare providers, health plans, and healthcare clearinghouses. And you may also encounter a business associate relationship if you retain the services of an entity to assist you in the creation, receipt, maintenance, or transmission of PHI. If an entity is not a covered entity or a business associate of a covered entity or a sub-business associate, essentially, then HIPAA will not apply. Next slide, please. So HIPAA broadly defines protected health information as any information, including demographics, that identifies an individual or could be used to identify an individual and that relates to the past, present, or future physical or mental health of an individual, the provision of health care to an individual, or payment for health care. Now, again, these terms are fairly broadly defined, and we'll go into that a little bit later in terms of the permitted uses and disclosures, which is actually the next slide. So next slide, please. So HIPAA has a number of different disclosures, and they generally fall into three categories: disclosures that are permitted, disclosures that are required, or disclosures that are permitted because they're authorized in writing by the individual who is the subject of the information. There are very few required disclosures under HIPAA, and those generally include to individuals when they request access to their information, an accounting of the disclosures of their PHI, or to the Department of Health and Human Services as part of an investigation or enforcement action. So going through these general ones, you see disclosures that are permitted include those to the individual, for treatment, payment, and healthcare operations, for an opportunity to agree or object and the individual agrees or does not object, incident to an otherwise permitted use and disclosure, public interest and benefit activities, or a limited data set for the purposes of research, public health, or healthcare operations. The one that primarily factors in to any sort of care coordination environment will be the ones that are permitted as treatment, payment, or healthcare operations. Treatment is also very, very broadly defined, and we look to both HIPAA and state law to see how that's determined. Now, HIPAA, it's going to include any sort of disclosure that's from a healthcare provider and relates to, let me see, I'm going to pull up my descriptions here. It's going to include information for care coordination purposes. It's going to include information for direct patient care, and that's reflected in state law as well. Payment's equally broadly defined, and it relates to claims payment, which is one of the more expected examples of it. It also is going to relate to disclosures to and from the health plan. It may relate to eligibility as well. Healthcare operations also addresses care coordination and quality assurance, quality assessment activities. Next slide, please. One of the areas under HIPAA that gets afforded special protection is psychotherapy notes. And this is distinct because HIPAA generally doesn't distinguish between any sort of records. They treat mental health records and physical health records primarily the same. The only exception, again, is psychotherapy notes. Psychotherapy notes are defined as notes recorded by a healthcare provider who is a mental health professional and that documents or analyzes the contents of a conversation during a private counseling session or a group, joint, or family counseling session, and that is separate from the rest of the patient's medical records. Given the sensitivity of this information and the fact that it may not relate to the care, it's more of the historic interactions of the patient or the particular personal details of it, that's why it's afforded this greater protection. As a result, a covered entity must obtain an individual's authorization to use or disclose psychotherapy notes except in very limited circumstances, and that includes the covered entity, of course, who created the notes and may use them for treatment. And a covered entity may use or disclose psychotherapy notes for training of their own staff members, for example, as an illustration to say this is how the patient presented with this condition and with these factors, and this is what we did. In legal proceedings brought by the individual, because that's only the sense of fairness, if the individual claims that somehow the care provided was inappropriate, the notes may provide guidance. Of course, for HHS investigations, given HHS's ability to require disclosure of information and to avert a serious and imminent threat to public health or safety. Next slide, please. When we look at authorizations, what I've done here is I've tried to compare and contrast the various authorization elements under HIPAA and both Oregon law. Now, Oregon law has a slightly different authorization form than you would see under HIPAA. And in fact, in our state law, we have an example within the regulations or statutes themselves. And a covered entity must obtain the individual's written authorization for any use or disclosure of PHI that is not for treatment, payment, or healthcare operations, or otherwise are permitted or required by law. Now here, on the right-hand side of the screen, you see the Oregon authorization elements. They mirror HIPAA to a great extent, but they add additional elements, and they require the boxes to be checked for disclosure of HIV or AIDS information, mental health information, genetic testing, and drug and alcohol diagnosis, treatment, and referral information. Now, this is not a form that is required to be used, even though these are, in fact, required elements. If a provider uses Oregon HIPAA authorization, then that is essentially a safe harbor, and it will protect you or protect you from a liability to a certain degree. Next slide, please. One of the issues that gets a lot of attention, particularly in the behavioral health setting, is instances in which disclosures may be made to friends and family members of a patient. Now, if a patient is present, the provider may disclose information to the patient's friend and family members in certain circumstances, clearly if the patient specifically consents to the disclosure. And this next bullet, the opportunity to object when there is no objection, that's essentially an instance in which a patient appears with a friend or family member at an appointment, and the provider starts to discuss the patient care, and there's an opportunity to object, and the provider says, would you like to have this information shared, and they say no. Similarly, if the patient keeps that person there and the provider doesn't afford that specific opportunity, but it can be applied from the circumstances, that's also a permitted disclosure. Different rules apply if the patient is incapacitated or absent or unable to disclose or consent, and this is going to be instances such as an emergency situation. And here, the provider must exercise a certain degree of professional judgment in determining whether to disclose PHI. you have to look at various factors. And you can only disclose protected health information that's directly relevant to the person's involvement with the patient's care. For those of you who are very familiar with HIPAA, this is essentially the minimum necessary standard. If it's not, if there's someone who's helping out with payment and that's their role with respect to this particular individual, you cannot then disclose everything about the patient's treatment to that individual, except to the extent it directly relates to the payment. If there is a disclosure to someone other than a friend or family member, the provider must be reasonably sure that the patient has involved the person in the patient's care. This can be something that you can identify just by reaching out to the patient or reaching out to the person to understand their role. And this might be more something that comes up in the care coordination setting. One thing to keep in mind that a healthcare provider is not required by HIPAA to share a patient's information when the patient is not present or is incapacitated, and the provider can choose to wait until the patient has an opportunity to agree to the disclosure. Also, while it's not necessarily required, it's often beneficial to identify the basis for the disclosure. You want to ensure that you know who this person is, but you don't need to require proof of identity either. Next slide, please. Now, when we look at Oregon laws, there's some subtle differences there, obviously, between Oregon laws and HIPAA, and there's a lot that comes into play with respect to CCOs. I've listed a few of the more relevant or dominant statutes on this topic here for your review. ORS 192.561, and this is actually very interesting because it does say, notwithstanding ORS 179.505, a healthcare provider that is a participant in a coordinated care organization shall disclose protected health information. So this law has actually modified the public provider laws and the behavioral health laws in 179.505, which we'll touch upon briefly in a moment. And this is a shall disclose, which is very important to note. There's a relevant or related provision right below, which is ORS 414.6793. Notwithstanding ORS 179.505, a coordinated care organization, its provider network, shall use and disclose member information for purposes of service and care delivery, coordination, service planning, transitional services, and reimbursement. So again, they're going on to modify the other state laws we have in effect right now regarding disclosures for information. Now, the statute goes on to say that a coordinated care organization and its provider network shall use and disclose sensitive diagnosis information, including HIV and other health and mental health diagnoses, within the coordinated care organization for the purpose of providing whole person care. That's ORS 414.6794. These provisions seem to require disclosures in circumstances when HIPAA and the other Oregon privacy laws would merely permit them. They also seem to negate the effect of ORS 179.505 and other laws protecting the confidentiality of sensitive diagnosis information. At this time, we really haven't seen how these laws have played out in real time, so their application may be a bit uncertain still. Next slide, please. So this is the law we just talked about a bit, and this is one of the kind of the hallmark laws that we've looked to for several years in terms of determining what can be disclosed, particularly with respect to mental health information. So ORS 179.505 permits certain public providers, as they are defined by law, to disclose information regarding individually identifiable health information in certain circumstances. So public providers that are subject to this law are very broadly defined and include Department of Corrections institutions, community mental health programs, facilities or services authorized by the Oregon Health Authority to provide treatment for alcoholism, drug addiction, or mental and emotional disturbances. So looking next to the 179.505(2), public providers may not disclose records containing individually identifiable health information unless the records fall within certain specified exceptions or when the use or disclosure is otherwise permitted or required by state or federal law. Now, the exceptions that are referenced here include some that have already been referenced with respect to 42 CFR Part 2 or HIPAA. So they can be disclosed upon the written authorization from the individual or the personal representative of the individual, as long as the provider is identified, the name of the person to whom the disclosure is made is also listed, the name of the individual is specified, and the nature of the information to be disclosed is identified as well. Similar to what you've seen under HIPAA and 42 CFR Part 2, this must include a statement that the authorization is subject to revocation at any time. Additional exceptions include something that's a disclosure is necessary to meet a medical emergency, to officers or employees of the provider who are currently acting within the official scope of their duties to evaluate treatment programs, to diagnose or treat, or to assist in diagnosing or treating an individual, legal proceedings brought against the state. But these records cannot be used to initiate or substantiate any criminal, civil, administrative, legislative, or other proceeding against the individual unless the individual, as a party to the action, voluntarily produces evidence regarding an issue to which those records are going to be relevant. In a way, this harks back to 42 CFR Part 2, which is the goal of encouraging treatment without having the full disclosure from the patient limited by fears of some sort of retribution. You can also disclose information under ORS 179.505 if the individual poses a clear and immediate danger to others or to society. Next slide, please. Minors and mental health always pose a challenge because it's such a delicate balance. You want to make sure that the minor gets the care that they need, but respecting the rights of the parent to be involved in the care and actually respecting the role of the parent to help facilitate follow-up care as needed. ORS 109.675 provides the minor 14 years of age or older the ability to obtain, without parental knowledge or consent, outpatient diagnostic or treatment of a mental or emotional disorder or a chemical dependency. Similarly, ORS 109.680 says a provider may, without the minor's consent, advise the parent or parents or legal guardian of any minor the outpatient diagnosis or treatment for a mental or an emotional disorder whenever the disclosure is clinically appropriate and serves the best interests of the minor's treatment. Next slide, please. There's been a lot of legislation, as you all know, with respect to healthcare in Oregon and at the federal level as well. These are just a snapshot of some of the laws that were of particular note for healthcare and coordination of information. Now, House Bill 2023 is effective 1/1/16, and it requires hospitals to adopt and enforce policies for the discharge of a patient hospitalized for mental health treatment with the goal of better coordination of care and connection to support systems at the time of discharge. The policies must be publicly available and include the following. A patient must be encouraged to sign an authorization to permit the disclosure of information necessary for a lay caregiver to participate in discharge planning. It's not required that the patient has a lay caregiver. It's simply something that the provider must encourage the patient to obtain. Policies must also assess the patient's risk of suicide with input from the lay caregiver if one has been designated and if such input is appropriate. So it's also assess the long-term needs of the patient, including need for community-based services, capacity for self-care, and care within the patient's residence. A lot of the bills that we've seen this year came from the fact that there's instances in which patients have had mental health issues where they've been discharged without there being a safety net of sorts in place. And this is one of the two laws this past session that specifically addressed that. One other important fact of House Bill 2023 is it requires the hospital to schedule follow-up appointments no later than 7 days after discharge or document why the 7-day goal could not be met. House Bill 2948 was effective June 18, 2015, and it's also known as the Susanna Blake Gabay Act. It amends Oregon law to clarify the instances in which a provider may disclose PHI to a friend, family member, or other party involved in an individual's care. This bill closely parallels the disclosures to third parties permitted under HIPAA and expressly permits providers to disclose information, including behavioral health information, to a person identified by the individual, provided the PHI is directly relevant to the person's involvement with the individual's care, to a family member, personal representative, or another person responsible for the care of the individual to notify the person of the individual's location, general condition, or death. And the bill permits but does not require the aforementioned disclosures if the individual is not present or is otherwise unable to consent to the disclosure and the provider, and the exercise of professional judgment determines that the disclosure is in the best interest of the patient. House Bill 2948 also permits disclosure when the individual is present and the provider receives express or tacit consent to disclose PHI to another person. The bill also permits a provider to disclose PHI if the provider believes in good faith that such disclosure is necessary to prevent or lessen a serious threat to the health or safety of any person or the public, provided the information is disclosed only to a person who is reasonably able to prevent or lessen the threat. You'll see that this actually almost word for word mirrors HIPAA, but the reason it was enacted was to make it clear that behavioral health providers can disclose information to the friends and family members of a patient in certain circumstances. The last bill listed is actually joint memorial, and it urges Congress to pass legislation to better align 42 CFR Part 2 with HIPAA. And this is something that both Leslie and Kate have mentioned as well, that one of the challenges is that there are so many different laws that come into play, and 42 CFR Part 2 has been a bit of an older law. It's something that may need to be updated or could benefit from being updated, and any sort of changes to it could have the ability of greater care coordination efforts. And I believe that's the last of my slides, and we will have time, I think, considerable time at the end for questions.
Thank you, Deanna. I know there were a few questions that came up for your section, so we'll cover those in a little bit during the Q&A session. So now we're going to transition over to Laura Roses, who will provide an overview of the federal efforts around behavioral health and health information technology. Laura, are you online?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Great. Thank you so much. So I'll talk a little bit about the work that we've been doing. Next slide. So just give you some context, I think we've all recognized both as a department and as a nation that we need to coordinate patients' care and that care needs to be patient-centered. Certainly increasing the adoption of health IT and EHRs both provides challenges and opportunities. A major goal of the department is greater interoperability. We've done a lot of work in that area. We've really worked a lot with, in terms of our grantees in developing electronic client data sharing. And we've also worked a lot on providing technical assistance on 42 CFR Part 2, as well as working with OCR on doing TA on HIPAA. And also OCR in particular, which owns the HIPAA privacy and security rules, has done a lot of work reaching out to both providers and to patients on the right to share and withhold information, as well as we've been working a lot on data segmentation. Next slide. Those are animated. But there are barriers to sharing behavioral health information electronically. Part 2 providers lack often the financial and workforce resources to adopt EHRs and to interface with HIEs. There are standards known as data segmentation for privacy. They are balloted normative standards with HL7. There was a significant amount of work done on this about 2 years ago, where SAMHSA, the VA, and ONC worked to develop these standards, and they have been integrated into some EHR products. Cerner notably did demonstrate this at HIMSS about 2 years ago, and we are continuing to work on implementing those standards, and I'm going to talk a little bit about our consent to share software, which is also based on DS4P. Nevertheless, HIEs have difficulty in segregating this information without DS4P, and there is a lag there. The ability to rapidly transmit information electronically, both for HIEs and just for everybody. I think we've all aware of sending an email to the wrong person, and just the speed of which the technology works creates different risks and different issues. And likewise, the adoption of EHRs and HIEs change the nature of risk and the scale. Next slide. One of the areas that we've been working on is on developing e-specified quality measures. So SAMHSA has been working with ONC and CMS and others in identifying measures that need to be retooled and e-specified. We've done an environmental scan for SAMHSA on prioritized areas. We've been developing and updating behavioral health-related e-clinical quality measures. This past year, we worked on a measure with the AAN, the American Academy of Neurology, on a measure to discourage the prescription of opioids in the emergency room for migraine headaches specifically. We've also worked on two other measures with serious mental illness and diabetes control and serious mental illness and hypertension control. We have been working on developing sort of our thoughts on what a EHR should have in terms of requirements for behavioral health. We'll be testing and validating ECQMs this year as well. Next slide. So our consent to share software is based on data segmentation for privacy. Next slide. You probably should click because I think there's a little bit of animation there. It is a tool that allows consent management based on DS4P, which is how we normally refer to data segmentation. It supports information exchange, and it's compliant with 42 CFR Part 2, and has the potential to be compliant with the laws of the jurisdiction which it's implemented, and I can speak to that in a few moments. Next slide. This is open source software that sits on GitHub. It manages consent. It can sit on an HIE, but it can also be used on a smaller organization. It segments the data. It integrates with EHRs and HIEs using the interoperability standards, and it applies client preferences and gives clients control of their information. Next slide. Recently, we just finished a pilot where we connected two methadone clinics, or OTPs, to an HIE, and we just wrapped that pilot up, and this next year we'll be looking to expand that pilot. We will also be providing some more technical assistance based on the lessons learned. Next slide. We have also implemented consent to share at Prince George's County Health Department. That was a pilot that has stayed in effect and is still functional. So it is live in that environment and enables data sharing protected by 42 CFR Part 2. It demonstrates how clients can establish their preferences utilizing a client portal. Next slide. So here you see the login page. So the way the workflow, and this is specific to how we implemented this in Prince George's County, which is an HIE, but that is also connected to a larger HIE. The client or the patient is provided a user ID and a password at the point of care, and then they would log in. So here you see login with C2S. At the bottom is there what is privacy consent, what is consent to share, how is my information shared. So there's some, you know, educational material focused at the patient. Next slide. Here, there is a list of providers in that network. So it has the name of the provider, the specialty, the provider's MPI number, their contact phone number, and their address. And the patient can also add a healthcare provider. Patient would choose the provider that they want to share their information from. So where is the information coming from? Next slide. So here the patient is giving their authorization. So it'll take their name. Here it says Albert Smith, here authorizes. And here's where they're going to choose the provider. Next slide. And here is where they choose their privacy settings. So this can be based on the jurisdiction where you are. So 42 CFR Part 2 is obviously a federal law that applies in all jurisdictions, but different states have laws that pertain to reproductive health, substance abuse, mental health, HIV. And so if you are in a jurisdiction or if an organization adopts a policy that they're going to treat information differently, this can be implemented differently in that jurisdiction. Here you can see the patient can decide not to share information in the following categories: drug abuse information, genetic disease, HIV AIDS, psychiatric information, sexually and reproductive health information, and alcohol abuse and alcoholism. So we've broken out alcoholism from drug abuse. And in this case, the patients decided not to share their drug abuse treatment information, their psychiatric information, their sexual reproductive health information, and their alcohol abuse. And that's why those boxes are checked. Next slide. Now, in this case, it's now showing them, here's the consent. So they've chosen the provider that's going to receive the information, and that provider is Teresa Luquin, is going to be sending the information to Monica Van Dongen, and the patient is going to share all of their information with the exception, and there it shows them that they're not sharing drug abuse, psychiatry, sexual and reproductive health, and alcohol abuse. Next slide. And here it captures the patient's consent through the EchoSign test document, and this will now be saved as a PDF. And it shows them the information that they're sharing and they're not sharing. Next slide. here's where the patient executes the consent. And it explain, and the language explains that the information cannot be disclosed. It has a 42 CFR Part 2 non-disclosure requirement. Next slide. Here's patient signature. Next slide. And here's a record of all of the consents the provider, the patient has given. So it says this, so the patient can see what information that they've held back, and then it will, the patient can go back and say, oh, I didn't provide that information, and then they can execute another consent and provide that information, and then they it captures that record that will always be there when the patient logs in and wants to view that part of their consents. Next slide. And that's thank you so much.
Great, thank you, Laura. We'll now have Nicole Corbin review some of the mechanisms that can be used to share information between providers.
Hello, everyone. We've had kind of a very, very large global view about the different issues related to confidentiality. And so I would like to talk a little bit now on a more small level for the providers who are out there in the audience, or for the people who are managing programs or managing businesses and trying to figure out how to do this correctly. Confidentiality, we've talked about the law and we've talked a little bit about the history. Kate mentioned some of the consequences that could happen when you have confidentiality violated, or when information about mental health or substance use disorder is shared. But it's important, I think, to remember that this is not just a barrier to us getting work done, that confidentiality is really critical. In particular, it is made necessary by a tremendous history of stigma and criminalization of addiction and, to a lesser degree, mental health issues. Prior to having laws protecting confidentiality, it was not uncommon, for example, for police officers to go to alcohol and other drug treatment facilities and arrest people who were in group therapy there. It was also not uncommon for people to lose their jobs if it became known that they had sought treatment for a mental illness. So we still have people that we are treating in our systems right now who may have direct experience with that sort of thing. It is not so long ago that it is such ancient history that no one will remember it. So I bring that up so that we are aware of the importance of it, but also the critical need that I think we all have to share information. Just an example of how that can matter. Back in my prior life, many years ago, one of the first clients that I was treating had severe psychosis, and she presented that psychosis in a way that didn't look as crazy as people would stereotypically think. She was very quiet, unless she was frightened, in which case she was tremendously aggressive. But she also had enormous health problems, and that she desperately needed to have her teeth removed because she had a tremendous infection and impacted teeth, but she kept getting fired from dentists because she was angry and aggressive when she was frightened. And there was absolutely no way for her to succeed in having her healthcare needs addressed until there was coordination between her mental health treatment and her physical health treatment to explain and understand that this was a reaction due to anxiety. And that was very difficult to do until really creating consents to treatment and consents to share information. And so I always like to try and take these examples back to the individuals that we're trying to serve. Nobody here wants to waste money on inappropriate treatment. Nobody here wants to get in legal trouble for failing to follow the law. But fundamentally, all of us are here because we want the human beings that we're providing services for to get good services. So I like to bring that back to the human being. So now what do we do? We know it's important. What do we do? There are a number of different ways that you can, in fact, disclose information under 42 CFR and HIPAA. We've talked about quite a few of them already. I'm going to speak in detail about proper consent and qualified service organizations or business associate agreements. But I also did just want to mention, we had a question come up earlier during Deanna's talk about child abuse reporting. And so I did want to just clarify that reporting suspected child abuse and neglect is one of the times that an individual is permitted to disclose protected health information without any sort of additional consent. I would also recommend that one should get consent if possible in a situation like that. But we're talking about a lot of mandatory reporters in our audience here who know that they have to report, and I just want to clarify that, yes, you do have an exception under 42 CFR Part 2 and HIPAA that you can disclose information in that instance. However, it is also important to realize that when you make that disclosure, you do need to document it in the record, even if there is no formal consent. So as I said, today we're going to talk about a little bit more about consent to treatment and consent to share information. I got a slight bit rattled up here, and about qualified agreements. So let's start with the first and most practical and most common use for getting a way to share confidential health information while complying with 42 CFR and HIPAA. And this is something that we don't need to wait for the federal law to change. We don't need to wait for any additional infrastructure to be created. This is something that people can do right now, and many are doing, and that is to have a patient voluntarily choose to disclose information. We usually call these releases of information. There's a lot of details about what needs to be in a correct release of information. And so those are listed up there. But I think that it is important for us to also realize that we usually think about releasing information to other providers, but it's also important to remember that a family member is a superb part of truly coordinated care, and that family members are also someone that we can release information for. It's common and probably easiest to obtain these consents, these releases of information, during the time of admission to a treatment program, or when a patient is able to rationally communicate, because we know that some of the folks that we see come into treatment programs in a state that is not able to give informed consent at that moment. But when they are, patients need to be given a written summary of CFR Part 2 regulations when they have intake. And so that's a good time to do consent. I think it's also very important to remember that we want people to have informed consent, which is why it's not okay to just have a client sign a blank release of information and say, oh, well, we'll figure it out later once we know your PCP's address. And it's also helpful to explain to the clients why it's good for them to actually sign and share this information. I think sometimes, again, because we know that there's so much high-level stuff here and so much work that has to be done to do a good intake on a client, that it's easy to sometimes say, well, just here's the stack of papers, and, yeah, we want you to sign for your PCP, and, yeah, we want you to sign for your partner or spouse. And that is not always something that a client is going to feel safe and want to do, particularly when you think about that history of stigma. So you're much more likely to have success if your clinicians or some places there are admin or support staff that are helping with the paperwork. If instead of saying, oh, well, will you sign this because it's our policy, we want to talk to your PCP, you would instead say, hey, will you sign this to talk so that we can share information with your PCP if we need to? It's very important because we may prescribe medications for you here, and your doctor is likely to do that as well, so we want to make sure that it's safe for you and that there's no bad medication interactions. For example, it's much easier to get truly informed consent if we give people a reason of why coordinated care is actually a helpful and good thing for the people that we're trying to treat. Okay. Consents can be two-way. You can have an authorization that will allow me as the treatment provider to give information to the primary care provider and have the primary care provider give information back to me, or that can be one-way. And there were some great examples, actually, in the slides that Laura showed that give details of the fact that clients can choose very specifically what they want to disclose. Yeah, you can talk about this, but not this. Or I want you to share this information with the primary care doctor, but I don't want him or her to share anything back to you. So clients have a lot of choice and a lot of right in what they are sharing. And clients, again, are much more willing to share that if they understand that coordinated care is beneficial to them. You want to make certain that those consent forms are structured in a way that makes it clear what information can be given to what people and for what reasons. And it's also important to realize that a patient can choose to revoke consent if they want to. Obviously, if, you know, I've given you consent to talk to my spouse up until today, and now I say, no, I don't want that to happen anymore, any previous disclosures can't somehow, they don't go away, and they don't become unauthorized, but anything going forward does. And it's important to make sure that a revocation of a consent is documented clearly in the patient record, because a client can revoke that consent with a written form, but they can also do it verbally, and so it's very important to make sure that that's documented. Thank you. Good. And it's also very important, we've mentioned this again before, but it's very important to understand that any disclosure of protected health information that is made with, even with a consent to release information, cannot be redisclosed. So if I'm sending this signed consent to the PCP, the PCP cannot redisclose that information to anyone else, and vice versa. So again, that is one of the things that is sometimes challenging in providing good coordinated care. If you've got someone who has complex needs, they've got a substance use disorder treatment provider and a mental health provider and perhaps an aging services provider, and they're involved in child welfare, and they've got a primary care doctor and maybe an attorney, and it would be helpful for all of those people to really be on the same page and be coordinated. That means multiple sharings of information and multiple consents, because you cannot redisclose further information, even verbal disclosures. And there's a good form, there's a sample notice of that information, because you want to, when you send that information out to another provider, you want them to know very clearly that they can't redisclose it. And there's a sample form on the legal action form there. The other mechanism that we can already use, that we can put into place right now without having to wait for changes, is a qualified service organization agreement. A qualified service organization agreement is an agreement between a Part II program and another entity providing service. It authorizes those two entities to communicate in the information that's necessary for the QSOA to perform its duties under the QSOA. So that means you can't share everything, but you share the information that is necessary for each part to do their work. So if you are talking about, for example, a CCO that's providing medical and care coordination services to a Part II entity, and the Part II entity is a substance use provider, they can share information that is necessary. They can share information about, say, for example, prescriptions, or about medical conditions that might compromise the person's health, and it's something for both sides of that equation to be aware of. But you would not be able to share information, for example, on some of the psychotherapy notes, as has been mentioned before, that contain very personal or very serious private information that is not necessarily relevant to, say, someone's medical treatment that might be shared at their substance use disorder provider. So when 42 CFR was originally created, it really was of the thought that most treatment for alcohol and other drugs would be provided at a specialized alcohol and other drug treatment program. And that's how it was for many years. But we did not foresee CCOs, right? We didn't foresee coordinated care. We didn't foresee electronic medical records and all of those different things that really enhance good outcomes, enhance good care, and decrease stigma when we treat a mental health or a substance use disorder just like any other sort of complicated illness that requires multiple specialists and that sees someone as a whole person who has many needs. So even though there are certainly still clients and certainly still people in the field who are going to feel appropriately protective of their client's confidentiality, as they should, there is a understanding that it truly is to the benefit of a client, of a patient now, to really have their information shared in a way that creates coordinated care. So again, talking about those qualified service organization agreements, we've mentioned that we're talking about the organization that provides services to a Part II program. Again, this could be data processing or bill collecting or doing the lab analysis of someone's urinalysis. So those people will have a much smaller amount of information that is shared, right? You're not going to share any clinical information to a bill collecting agency. But it's completely appropriate to share information about a client's insurer and about their address and about their phone number. So all of these are services that we need to have our organizations work, And all of these are things that we, in fact, can share appropriate information with. It's important to note there will be a written agreement. The program acknowledges that in receiving and storing and processing and otherwise dealing with any of this very confidential information, it is fully bound by privacy as well. So when you've got that bill collecting agency or that accounting agency, they also have to comply with regulations on how to safely store this information and how to not redisclose it. And if necessary, that also means that that anyone who is in that QSOA will resist in judicial proceedings any effort to obtain access to patient records unless those are permitted by law, which means not just, you know, you don't want your accounting firm turning over private client information if there's a subpoena. You want them to appropriately require a court order because that's a high-level requirement to protect that confidential information. One of the things that we want to do is promote effective communication between, particularly my expertise, between substance use disorder treatment and primary care providers. Again, this talks about, we know that people who come into the behavioral health system with mental health issues, with substance use disorder issues, have a tremendous amount of physical challenges and physical needs that they perhaps have not always been having addressed because of poverty, because of their behavioral health issues. So consent forms create communication sort of in a one-on-one matter for each individual client. That's part of a wonderful treatment plan. They authorize very specific information. They can be two-way. And then on the slightly larger scale, the QSOAs are the communication not so much about each individual provider, but between multiple agencies or entities that provide services together. They authorize providers to disclose the other healthcare information. It's the macro level of a consent to share information. And again, both of these things allow information to be shared as needed, but are still bound by rules about redisclosure and by section confidentiality. So it is an effort to have that balance between protecting the very important confidentiality of a client and providing the critical coordinated care.
Great. Thank you, Nicole. So now we'll review some next steps and resources that are available to all of you. Please make sure to visit the advisory group's webpage at the link here showing on the screen. There are several state and national resources, including some sample forms like QSOAs, consent forms, the redisclosure notice that we covered. There's a lot of information, I think great information on there that you all might be able to use. So you can also find the contact information on the page for the policy leads, and feel free to email any other questions after the webinar has concluded. As Leslie Clements stated earlier, the next webinar is tentatively scheduled for November 10th from 1 to 3 p.m. We will post more information as we get closer to that date on that web page that I mentioned. And we will also send out emails. Going forward, the advisor group will collaborate on the Office of the National Coordinator grant that was received by the Office of Health Information Technology and Jefferson Health Information Exchange. We will also highlight this effort in a future webinar. And as Leslie stated earlier, the group will also develop a sample qualified service organization agreement that can be used by providers. And that will be a part of the provider toolkit that was also noted earlier. We will also review the toolkit and the QSOA in a future webinar. So now I'd like to transition over to questions. And as I mentioned earlier, please submit your questions using the question box. Any remaining questions that are not answered today, we will compile responses for those questions and post on our webpage. So the first question that we have here, why are QSOAs needed between providers? HIPAA allows providers to exchange information for treatment, payment, and operation purposes. So Deanna, Nicole, or Kate, would you like to take a stab at that?
Sure. This is Kate. I can take a stab. So for 42 CFR Part 2, there is no exception for treatment purposes, unlike HIPAA. Part 2 requires consent when sharing information for treatment purposes. So either the provider would need to obtain consent from the patient to get that information, or you know, one of the other exceptions would need to apply, such as the either medical emergency or probably QSO. And that's mainly because the Part 2 restrictions are stricter than the HIPAA requirements, because they're dealing with sensitive information that could potentially, if it was erroneously disclosed, could potentially have some negative consequences for the patient.
Great, thank you. Can a patient sign an authorization to include their medical record information to have that record included in an HIE and not violate the redisclosure requirement? Kate, Deanna?
So this is Kate again. So under 42 CFR Part 2, the patient, if the HIE is allowing behavioral health information to be included, they would need to sign a Part 2 compliant consent form. Part 2 requires, in the to whom section of the consent requirements, it requires a level of specificity that's not required by HIPAA, so you have to name the specific individual organization. Naming the HIE itself, would the information could go to the HIE, but it could not go to the participating providers within that HIE, so it wouldn't flow down further down. So you would have to list on the consent form the HIE and all of the participating providers if you wanted the information to go everywhere within the HIE. And the issue that HIEs and CCOs and ACOs are having is that because the provider base is constantly changing, the consent forms have to be constantly updated. Under the current regulations, the consent does need to list all of the providers within the HIE. If you did just list the HIE itself, it wouldn't flow to any of the participating providers because of the prohibition on redisclosure notice.
There was a question, Laura, about the consent to share platform and whether that is still in the development phase or if there has been any discussion or planning to ensure that it will be provided in multiple languages or options for visually impaired patients, and then also if it's been successful anywhere or whether it's still in demo phase.
So it's in production at Prince George's County still. It was a pilot, and they've continued to use it. The pilot that we did with the HIE and the two methadone clinics used DS4P, but not consent to share. They used the proprietary implementation of data segmentation for privacy. We are in the process. It is consent to share is available on GitHub, and if you want to share my email with folks, I can direct them to where it sits. We are updating it to have it become a CCDA and also working on refining it, but it is available in its current form free and open source, and we are continuing to refine it, and it is in production in PG County in Maryland. We can also put folks in touch with the leadership at PG County if they want to discuss how to implement, and we can also provide technical assistance for implementation.
Great. Thank you. So a question about the HIE. If an HIE has a list of participating providers on their website, does that satisfy the redisclosure requirement or I think that actually this question is about the providers that need to be listed on the consent form.
So the latest guidance we've received from working with our general counsel and listed in our frequently asked questions is basically that it would have to be included as like an attachment to the consent form. So, and that is, you know, our frequently asked questions were last updated in 2011. And that basically at the time was because, you know, it wasn't clear that, you know, every folk had access to a computer to look up, you know, exactly which providers they were consenting to share their information with. So currently it is not sufficient to just have the list of providers on the website. It would have to be like printed out and included as either an attachment or a PDF if it was electronically.
Right.
But again, as I mentioned in my portion of the presentation, we know that the Part 2 regulations are, you know, not updated to the healthcare models and health information technology that we're working with today within healthcare. So that is something we're looking at as we analyze the regulations and look at the different provisions that need to be updated.
Great, thank you. So another question about if someone could speak to the use of addictions data, both administrative through claims and clinical through an EHR system for population health purposes, plan level care coordination, and similar uses. What's allowed, what's off limits? Laura, would you be able to take a stab at that? Or Kate?
Can you repeat the question again? Sorry, Kate, did you get that?
No,
yes, I can repeat the question again.
And this is Deanna. I think the question might be a bit broad. We're trying to, I think, understand exactly what's being asked.
Yeah, so they basically want to know what information is allowed and what is off limits when looking at administrative claims data and clinical data through an EHR. So, and that's in regards to any information that's coming out of a Part 2 provider. Can you use that information for population health purposes, for plan level care coordination? What's possible? Yes, what's the realm of possibility?
Okay, so for 42 CFR Part 2, so for any information that's coming out of a Part 2 program, any of that information that would either directly or indirectly identify that patient as a substance abuser, for that information to be disclosed, you would need to obtain patient consent. So if the patient did consent to share that information, whether it's for care coordination or population health management purposes, you know, that would be allowable, but it would be that you would need patient consent, or it would have to meet one of the other limited exceptions.
This is Nicole. It's also, I think sometimes people are kind of pushed back against that, and it's important to remember that that's any information that could identify the patient. So in a large area or a large community, you might be able to look at claims data and provide some planning or public health or community information without identifying anyone, but that can be risky in smaller pools of people. In a smaller community, if you have only, you know, one male person who has this particular diagnosis or treatment, even if you don't have any names attached to that information, you have inadvertently violated confidentiality by giving information that can identify the individual.
And from a HIPAA and an Oregon state law perspective, if it's truly addiction information, it's going to be more likely governed by 42 CFR Part 2. But there would be the ability in a care coordination setting for the information to be shared and for the information to be used for anything that falls within the purview of treatment, payment, or healthcare operations, which can include the organization's own assessment of its work, claims audit information, and things of that nature.
Great. Thank you, everyone. Deanna, these two questions here are for you. Can you elaborate on public interest and benefit activities, the points that you included on your slide? And then can you describe how psychotherapy notes differ from service or progress notes that document the the pieces, or rather the content of the service that was provided.
Certainly, and I'm actually going to go with the second question first. So psychotherapy notes are basically, again, you know, this is the patient's personal details. So they're not even reporting on the medications the patient is taking or any sort of progress they're making. It's the true details of their personal life. So if someone's been sexually abused as a child, it's going to be the level of detail surrounding that, the specific information regarding the abuse itself, the consequences from that, the patient's feelings about that, and things of that nature. You know, for example, if that played into a drug and alcohol situation, you can see how that could be just very sensitive information. The diagnosis and the progress notes are not having that same just tremendous level of personal detail, and therefore they're not subject to the same protections under HIPAA. And I'm not sure if that's answering the question, if that's sufficient level of detail for that purpose. But then going on to the first one, public interest and benefit activities, that's going to be a lot of things, like some disclosures for disclosures that are required by law, permitted by law, things that are going to go, it's not so much the public health, but it would fall within certain public health related activities such as disease reporting, and I can provide additional information in the notes to my presentation. As I understand, I think there were comments that, I don't know if it was directed at me personally, but I think that many of us, due to the time constraints, spoke very quickly, and I can add additional detail on that particular slide in my notes as well.
Perfect. Another question about when a patient's family is present, does the patient need to provide written consent or does verbal consent suffice?
Actually, when the patient's family is present and the patient is not incapacitated, they don't even need to have written consent under HIPAA to share that information. It's simply that's the opportunity so the patient can verbally agree that they want the person that's present to hear the information, or again, they can have that tacit consent, which is that if the provider says, you know, do you want, you know, is it okay if I disclose this information with your family members present, and the person, you know, shrugs their shoulders or just waves it off or somehow doesn't verbally consent, that can still suffice under the circumstances. It is beneficial, though, to put it in the notes of the visit so that can't be challenged later on. So say, for example, if the provider mentions that a patient appeared with mother in tow, patient was advised that we were going to be discussing certain information, patient, you know, tacitly consented to disclosure information to her mother. I mean, that is just from a legal perspective, a safer mechanism or safer process to follow.
Great. And one other question about minor consent. Is minor consent needed for parents' request for records?
So if the parent's requesting the records on behalf of their own child,
yeah.
This is unfortunately one of these horrible gray areas in the Oregon law, because what happens is the argument is that if a patient is old enough to consent to the particular care, then they should be able to be the one who executes any sort of authorization regarding the disclosure of that information. But it's not clear. I mean, from our perspective, from my department's perspective, we tend to take the position that if the minor can consent to the care, then they have the ability to be the one that signs the authorization rather than the parent.
Great.
But again, I have to emphasize it's something that is a bit vague under the current law.
Okay. A question about the ORIS, the statutes that we reviewed that were pertinent to Oregon. Are those sufficient to override 42 CFR Part 2 rules, and are those in compliance or in compliance with a higher federal law?
And this is Deanna. I'll take that first part, and I would say no, they're not going to overrule 42 CFR Part 2. The law that is the most protective is always going to prevail, and so 42 CFR Part 2 is likely going to be the more restrictive law, and Kate can probably speak to that as well. In terms of the laws themselves, HIPAA is very vague in some of their definitions, and they do have a certain disclosure for care coordination. So I would assert that all of these laws are consistent with care coordination activities and the permitted care coordination disclosures under HIPAA. But again, I don't see that this would overrule 42 CFR Part 2.
Kate, do you have anything to add there?
No, I would just agree with Deanna that, you know, 42 CFR Part 2 is very restrictive. There's very few states that have laws that are stricter than Part 2, but
as she stated, that HIPAA is the floor and that many states do have laws that are more restrictive than HIPAA.
Next question. What is the recommended recourse of a healthcare entity when another entity follows a more restrictive interpretation of privacy laws in such a way that actually affects patient care and care coordination? Is there an OHA department that can be appealed to or offer mediation? So I will go ahead and answer a portion of this. I think one of the things that we have heard from various providers is that there are obviously, you know, as this question precisely states, that there are differences in how the privacy laws are interpreted. And so that is part of our effort, of the advisory group's effort. You know, we're trying to set uniform standards and protocols, such as, you know, having a QSOA or a common consent form that can be used by everyone, and have these educational trainings that can help everyone, I think, really level set and understand what the laws say and what's allowed and not allowed under privacy laws, both at the federal and state level. And as far as whether there is an OHA department that can be appealed to or offer mediation, I would say that if you are a provider within a CCO, that it's probably a great idea to reach out to your CCO and have them function as an intermediary to try to resolve the issues. We will be in OHA, and the advisory group will have discussions with the CCOs and will bring a lot of this information to them. So, I think eventually we hope to all have all CCOs and all providers on the same page. So, next question. When a disclosure does not seem to violate HIPAA, but does violate the stricter 42 CFR Part 2, what are the reporting requirements for the covered entity? Deanna or Kate, do you want to tackle that one?
I'm not sure whether you know, are they talking about when there is a violation of 42 CFR Part 2, how is that reported?
I think so. That's what it seems like.
Okay, so under SAMHSA has the authority over Part 2 and the administration of Part 2, but SAMHSA doesn't have the legal enforcement authority that lies within the Department of Justice. For reporting violations with regard to Part 2, they can be directed to the U.S. Attorney for the judicial district in which the violation occurs. And then if there's a report of any violation by an opioid treatment program, they can be reported to both the U.S. Attorney's Office and to SAMHSA, because SAMHSA does certify those programs. But as far as the reporting of violations, it would go directly to the U.S. Attorney's Office.
All right, next question. Is information generated by the provision of screening, brief intervention, and referral to treatment services or expert services covered by Part 2?
So this is Kate. So and in determining whether expert is subject to 42 CFR Part 2, it really depends on whether the entity conducting the expert activities meets the definition of a federally assisted program under Part 2. So if the entity conducting expert services is not a federally assisted program, then the expert services and patient records generated by such services would not be covered by Part 2, although HIPAA and other state laws may apply. But if the entity conducting the expert services does meet the definition of a federally assisted program under Part 2, then the expert records that were generated would be subject to 42 CFR Part 2.
And this is Nicole. It's also important to note that if the expert does indicate that someone would benefit from substance use disorder treatment, and they're then referred to treatment, even if they, the original screening expert was conducted by a non-Part 2 entity so that it wasn't subject to 42 CFR, the treatment that they were referred for would be.
Great, thank you. When a doctor prescribes medications that are used for substance use disorders, does that bring a medical clinic, does it cover the medical clinic under Part 2? And some of the examples of those medications might include Suboxone, Naloxone, or other medications that are used to treat substance use disorders.
So this is Kate, and there's no yes and no answer. It really does depend, and it would depend, as I mentioned, whether the provider who is prescribing the medication, whether they are they meet the definition of a program. So if it's a provider who works in a primary care practice who is prescribing buprenorphine, and they do maybe for like four or five of their patients, likely that's not their primary function, and they likely are not identified as the addiction specialist within the practice. So they would not meet the definition under Part 2. But if they're working in a primary care practice and their primary function is for the provision of addiction treatment and they're prescribing these medications, then yes, they would meet the definition of a program. So it all depends on what their role is and whether they would meet the definition of a program or not.
Great. A few questions about ROIs. When an ROI references a specific person's name, for example, a particular PCP, does this cover release of that particular information that's shared with that PCP to other PCPs in that office or perhaps other PCPs in the network? Deanna, Kate?
I'm not really sure. Can you repeat the question, please?
Great. Well, so we will answer that question after, and any of the remaining questions at the on the web page will provide responses, as I mentioned. Thank you, everyone, for attending the webinar. And once you leave, you'll receive a survey, and we would really appreciate it if you could provide your feedback on today's event. And as was mentioned, a follow-up email will be sent to you with the recording and the slides, and we'll also post that on our webpage. Thank you so much for attending.